deadly close. She powered up the cannon and quickly set its parameters. One of the Spartans, she thought it was Mike, narrowly survived a massive blow from two Sharkoi. He was tossed across the ground toward the ledge, his pursuers close behind. Nearest to Hecabe, Rajka disappeared under a sea of corded gray muscle. Elise waited a split second for the shifting bulk of Sharkoi to reveal Hecabe, then quickly turned the switch and stabbed the firing button with a thumb. The cannon whined. The blue Forerunner lighting in the structure ahead of them flickered, the EMP taking its toll. The blast was mostly silent and sightless, invisible to the naked eye. A few last thuds and roars punctuated the cavern before an eerie silence dropped down over them. The Forerunner structure went dark, with only the lava below to light the cavern interior. Elise could see enough to know that the cannon had worked. Hecabe stood stunned on the dais. His hammer dropped from his hand as the Sharkoi suddenly lolled around him. One Sharkoi to her right staggered over to the side of the bridge and simply disappeared over the edge. "Strike confirmed," Chai said. "Adriana, Mike, report!" "We're going to get him again, just to be sure." Elise quickly reset the keys on the cannon and fired again. Alarms flashed and buzzed on the weapon's display. Wisps of smoke rose in the air from burned-out circuits, unable to handle the sheer amount of power dumped through them. She checked the screen of the power unit. The cannon's shot. The Havoc powering it is still functional, though. If it comes to that. The Sharkoi still wandered around, ambling as though blind or asleep. Elise imagined that they were not sure what was happening, having been suddenly yanked free of their neural connection. Whatever it was, they likely had a limited window. "Governor," the envoy called out, "did it work?" Elise didn't answer, but ran toward Hecabe, cautiously weaving between the lumbering Sharkoi before they could come to their senses. She passed under the massive Forerunner entrance and through the gate. Behind her, Jai heaved the pulse cannon to the ground and the other Spartans came up from behind. Lights on their helmets activated. She was close. So close now. The Jirohanai crouched on the ground, vomit and blood pooling in front of him. It seemed as though his injuries were taking their toll without the Forerunner device functioning to hold him together. This was her chance. Soraka would never be attacked again. Forcing aside fear, Elise swung her legs over onto the alien's back and dug her fingers into the metallic pieces of the Forerunner device that stuck out of his skull. She began to pull. Pieces of the device slowly separated from his head with a sickly ripping sound. They flowed back too and joined each other in her hands as Elise pulled them free of the Jirohanai's skull. Tendrils covered in blood and tissue slid out of Hecabe as Elise yanked even harder. "Governor!" Melody shouted. Dozens of confused Sharkoi scuffled, bellowing and howling behind Elise. Untold numbers of them filled the great chambers and passageways of the darkened Forerunner structure. They would be shaking free of the last of their confusion. But who knew what they would do when fully unhindered? They were like wild animals. Elise used her legs to push against Hecabe's back, to pull the last tendril free. The Jirohanai cried out in pain as the final section of Forerunner machinery broke away. Elise fell to the ground holding the device, which looked mangled and strange in her hands, as it seemed to struggle to flow back into some memory of an original shape. "No," Hecabe gurgled, clutching at his head as blood gushed down over his face. He slumped over and began to crawl, blindly searching for something. "The Sharkoi are approaching us," Adriana shouted. "Don't shoot them. They're confused," Jai announced. "Stay clear. Even better, stay still if you can." But stillness could only last so long. Gunfire lit up the dark near the far ledge, and Elise caught a glimpse of a Sharkoi chasing down the third Spartan, Mike. He narrowly dodged its blow, but others had now been signaled. They approached threateningly from the side. The Sharkoi might not be coordinated by Hecabe anymore, but there were hundreds of these things still up above in her city. How many more of her people would die, hunted by the Sharkoi now free of Hecabe's control? What if Sharkoy found citizens being evacuated? Or the oases? It's time for all this to stop, Elise said. She held up the gore-covered device. It shifted around in her hands, coming to life and slithering down her forearm, as the Forerunner structure behind her returned to a blue glow. The EMP was wearing off. My people will be safe once more. Elise held the alien machine over her head, and then let go. The Forerunner technology burrowed down through her temple, and eagerly wormed its tendrils through her skin and into her skull. She screamed as blood, Hecabe's and her own, dripped down her face as the artifact bore its way down into her brain. Rajka scrabbled out from underneath a heap of dead Sharkoy in time to see the Forerunner machine burrow down onto the human governor's head. As she began screaming, the now dying Hecabe jerked at the sound and fumbled about on the ground. His movements were confused, no doubt due to massive brain damage, as he appeared to look for something. With a groan, Hecabe managed to stand up with the aid of his gravity hammer, swaying back and forth for a moment. Then he stumbled toward the human. Rajka wasn't quite sure how the brute could even survive after what had happened to him. Yet Hecabe did. Against all odds. Rajka looked around for his sword, but turning caused him to ache despite himself. A broken left arm and several cracked ribs were bad enough, but something inside him hurt enough to leave him breathless. Hecabe was not the only one dying, Rajka realized with painful insight. The Sharkoy had dealt Rajka too many punishing hits. The mostly blind Hecabe heard Rajka's cry, and lashed out from his stupor to strike with his gravity hammer. The blow to the chest shattered Rajka's harness. He flew back, landing hard against the base of the nearest tower. Spitting blood, Rajka stood again, shaking himself back to consciousness amid the sound of Sharkoy thudding about, and someone screaming angrily. Now the human governor had stepped forward, just outside Hecabe's reach. Her eyes blazed with a hatred that Rajka suddenly realized was aimed not just at Hecabe, but at himself. He thought about the immense losses her people had taken in this pointless war that Tharz started. Thought about Melody Azakiwe's words. My nightmares look just like you. Governor, Rajka rasped, what are your intentions with that machine? It would be easy for her to take revenge, wouldn't it? To give in to fury and anger? To try and wipe this world clean of any threats to her city? Including Rajka and all his kind. Governor! A large, clawed Sharkoy hand forced him down to his knees and pinned him to the ground. Rajka saw the Demon Three surrounded by Sharkoy as well. A single creature held on to each Spartan, forcing them into a defenseless position. He wondered how many Sharkoy had died to capture them while he'd lain against the base of the tower, shaking himself back to consciousness. Would you like to try and kill me? Elise intoned, still standing beyond Hecabe's reach and ignoring Rajka. The Jirohanai, still free but unable to see out of his ruined face, spun around in the direction of Elise's voice, following the sound. Then he raised the massive hammer and blindly lunged forward. Humans, Hecabe thought, though his mind reeled and struggled to deal with all that had just taken place. He knew he wasn't whole. He knew he was a blade's edge away from death. He knew it was something to do with his head and his eye. He was missing so many things. Memories, thoughts, even feeling in his body. Physically, he was completely insensate. But he was familiar with the emotion he felt upon hearing these creatures. Rage. He was consumed with it. They had wronged him. And now they threatened everything. All that he had labored years for. He desired only one thing, to utterly annihilate this human right where she stood. Hecabe could feel Oath of Fury high in the air over him, faithful and ready to do his bidding. His back muscles strained to hold it, and then bring it swinging down toward her head. Within a split second, he would have safety. Everything would be made whole again. The gravity hammer struck something, and stopped halfway down. Struggling to see through the blood and flesh that covered his one good eye, Hecabe looked up to find a giant gray fist above him, holding the hammer's head like a small trinket. A Sharkoi had stopped the weapon in place just centimeters over the human's head. She had not even bothered to move out of its way. Hecabe let go of the hammer and reached for the human's neck, but the Sharkoi grabbed his wrist with its other hand. Another Sharkoi swiftly moved in and took hold of his other arm. Hecabe's chest stretched and strained against the impossible tension, threatening to rip him apart. He bellowed, spitting blood and defiance at the human in front of him, the one who dared to usurp his power over these creatures. Then two massive claws ripped through his chest, punching holes through his body that could never be repaired. He looked down at them, in confusion. Blood dripped from their tips onto the ground. His blood. Hecabe tried to scream his anger again, but all that came out was a burbling froth of red. The claws moved, taking him with them. They pulled him away from the human and lifted him into the air. Hecabe writhed, trying to pull himself free and continue his attack. It was all that was left in his brain, the last piece of a mental command that his body worked to fulfill. Get the vertex once more, and all of this could be mended. But the Sharkoi that speared Hecabe on its claws threw the Jirohanai out and away from the citadel, over the ledge, and down into the pit below. Everything, Hecabe thought, had been within my grasp. Now, everything fell away from him, as the world grew brighter and infinitely hotter. Chapter 26. The person who used to be Elise Gass watched Hecabe fall through the eyes of a dozen Sharkoi. The small form struck the lava far below, and something like a surge of satisfaction rolled through her. She could feel herself expanding out further through this new space. It was deep and rich, and it flooded her with new energy. This victory had been a close thing. Even as Hecabe attempted to kill her, she'd been struggling to figure out how to control the swirling pieces of the storm that whipped past her. But the storm had spoken. Calm yourself. Relax. Don't fight, it whispered. And Elise, who hadn't slept in well more than 5 days, who was beginning to see the edges of her vision melt and blur, fell toward the reassuring embrace of near omniscience with relief. She'd been so tired, so ineffably tired. Now, as Hecabe's threat faded completely away, Elise began to percolate her attention through the Sharkoi, and back to the spot that her body swayed upon. She knew she might collapse soon. It should have happened already. But her body was riddled with chemicals abusing her adrenal functions and resetting her neurochemistry. Fleeing out into this larger consciousness was like waking up after running on the edge for so long. Elise noticed Melody Azukiwe slowly pick up a battle rifle. "Don't do that, Envoy," she said through the Sharkoi that surrounded Azukiwe, "or I will be forced to neutralize you." The Envoy is Oni, Elise thought. She should have had a Sharkoi do that from the start. She was only just now learning how to wield this power still. Azukiwe dropped the rifle to the ground by her feet and raised her hands. The other dangers, the Spartans, were held in their place by many Sharkoi. The creatures also now gripped the Sangheili Kaidan, tightening their fists as he struggled in place. The threats to her had been negated. She could relax now.
Relax.
Rajka Kassan stared at her.
You planned this, the Sangheili said.
For some reason, she could understand his alien language now, through the senses of the Sharkoi.
No.
Elise looked at Rajka through sonar, his body a set of shifting audio reflections. The moment she had seen Hecabe on his hands and knees with the Sharkoi milling about in confusion, she had known exactly what had to happen. Although she had previously wanted to secure it for Soraka and stop the menace, it was only at the end that she could bring herself to do what truly needed to be done. Take the machine for herself. There was no other choice. It was the only way to make us safe, Elise told them.
Then why are you holding us? Jai called out.
Elise shifted her attention to the captives just outside the Forerunner walls. With a single thought, the Sharkoi dragged the Spartans back toward the base of the bridge, and she used another Sharkoi to nudge the envoy along. Another Sharkoi hoisted up Rajka, who still bucked under its iron grip, and followed the others. Elise joined them, using her own shaky human legs, and stopped by the ruined pulse cannon. She used her own tired human eyes to look at the Havoc nuke that was buried in the depths of the wires.
I don't trust you, Elise said. The Sangheili warred against Soraka. The Spartans are tools of Oni, created to attack people who want to govern themselves without interference from Earth's government. You are all threats, but I now have the power to protect this world.
Rajka glared at her.
You sound like Hecabe, he hissed. I am not Hecabe.
Elise screamed from hundreds of mouths, the sound echoing all throughout the cavern. Rajka pulled against the Sharkoi, still trying to break free.
And what does this new world look like? Will my people still live here?
Hundreds of Sharkoi appeared at the far side of the bridge. They marched in lines back toward the Forerunner towers. The moment the machine had burrowed into her skull, Elise had begun calling all of the Sharkoi back to her. All throughout Soraka, the creatures were doing everything within their power to return to the Forerunner structure. Many of them dragged Jiral Hanai that they had captured, despite the fact that a multitude of the defeated brutes had been trying desperately to hide, cowering away in the dark. As the Sharkoi returned, they threw screaming Jiral Hanai down into the lava below.
The Jiral Hanai, at least, are not welcome here, Elise said softly. Understand that this is my world. I will not let anyone harm it any longer.
Jai's joint popped loudly in his ears as his right shoulder nearly separated. Only the Mjolnir armor prevented it from being completely ripped out of its socket by the Sharkoi who held him. Alarms and his heads-up display told him the armor had been pushed far beyond tolerance levels. Any more pressure from the Sharkoi, and he would literally be torn limb from limb. The searing pain would have left any normal creature unable to even think. But Jai dug deep, breathing slowly. The UNSC will not allow this to stand. You'll bring far more destruction upon yourself than you've seen so far.
Ah, Earth. Always threatening us as well. You kept this a secret from us, and we paid for that instead of you.
Elise reached down through the cannon's wires, accessing the Havoc Corps' readout pane. She tapped the display.
There's a voice in here with me. It's telling me I shouldn't be doing this. But I know what has to be done. I have to make a hard choice. I'm pulling all the Sharkoi back in here right now. All of them. I'm going to end this. Jai was beginning to suspect that they had an entirely new problem on their hands.
Governor, what hard choice, he shouted. What are you doing with the nuke?
A gray wall of Sharkoi moved forward, forcing Melody further back onto the bridge. The Sharkoi holding the Spartans tossed them next to her with less care. They tumbled to a stop, with Rajka joining them a moment later.
There won't be much time,
the governor said through the mouths of all the Sharkoi around them.
I have already reopened the facility to let the remaining Sharkoi back in. The Havoc's timer is set for 10 minutes.
Jai, flexing his abused shoulder, glanced over at Rajka, who looked like he was in much worse shape.
But there are wisps of other things here with me,
the Sharkoi around them all said together.
Memories of others. They're very strong. They do not want me to do this, but it must happen, or everyone will keep trying to gain this power for themselves. The voices here, they'll try to stop me before long. So you should leave now. I might have to trigger this manually before the countdown. This is the only way to stop others from using this machine. It's the only way to protect Caro. So run for your lives. Right now, this world will be safe. It will be free.
Elise, Melody called out. We can't leave you.
I said, run,
the Sharkoi all boomed at once. Gray team fled. Mike hefted Melody and Rajka limped behind, his legs too damaged to keep up. They passed hordes of Sharkoi who moved across the bridge slowly and without direction.
The nuke will take out part of the city. There's no way we can get clear,
Melody shouted as they reached the bottom of the main shaft and began the race to the top.
I'm calling a pelican, Mike said. Comms are spotty, we're so deep down here. We'll need to get higher to be sure they're hearing us.
Can we trust her?
The governor? Jai asked Melody.
She was overusing stimulants.
She was in a bad place to begin with. But I think she loves this city. So that's why she's doing this.
The Sharkoi lining the sides of the ramps began to roar. They looked as though they were awaking from a slumber. The running Spartans climbed closer to the top with Rajka trailing behind. But it was a long way to the top via the spiraling ramps around the shaft's walls.
I'm feeling naked without a weapon here, Idriana said, wary of the Sharkoi's new behavior.
It now seemed like Elise was struggling to control the Sharkoi. Some of them lunged at the Spartans. Clearly a great internal battle was raging inside the governor's mind.
I don't think we're going to make it, Melody said, looking up toward the sky at the top of the shaft.
If Elise made good on her promise, the nuke would go off in only a few minutes, and they still had a long way to go to the surface.
Chapter 27
Elise wobbled and nearly fell. As her consciousness faded, the Sharkoi stepped back from her. She was losing her footing, both physically and mentally.
No, she needed to hold. Where are the Spartans?
She cast around inside the whirlwind and found them only halfway up the winding ramps leading to the crater. She wasn't going to hold it together long enough, and as her mind dissolved, the winds that dwelled inside fought to survive. Yes, she could still control the Sharkoi, but the machine's nature had been stained with traces of consciousness before hers, and these traces were fighting to live.
Even a shadow of Hecabe swam somewhere around here in the deep.
Elise skipped from mind to mind in the network of Sharkoi that hadn't made it back to the underground structure, until she found what she needed. She stood outside now. The militia had seen the Sharkoi turn around, give up the fight, and start moving back to the installation. The Sharkoi had formed lines and scrambled across the Ult, through the city streets, out of buildings, all to get to where Elise had summoned them. One of the Sharkoi turned back to the cautious militia shadowing them. They raised their weapons ready to fire. "This is Governor Elise Skass. The Jirahanai are no longer in control." The words came out muddled. She had to hope they could be understood. "I need you to do something very important." As a part of her spoke to the militia, another part of her saw the last of Hecabe's pilots aboard the command bridges of Sangheili's ships, the same vessels that had attacked her people only days ago. "The Jirahanai intended to use these warships to assault the Sangheili keeps. They'd already made several passes, destroying buildings from above with plasma fire. If she did nothing, within moments they would continue to rain fire down on the Sangheili. They would never recover. Humanity would reign over Soraka, supreme and unchallenged. Elise could take vengeance for the attack on her own city. Eye for an eye, blood for blood." "Make them pay," a voice whispered to her. "Ensure Soraka's safety." Elise balled her hands into fists and dug deep, past her desire for revenge and through the pain. Sharkoi charged past the Jirahanai and began battering against the ship's controls and displays until something critical was damaged. The Jirahanai on each ship attempted to fight back, but it was too late. The ships plummeted toward the Ult's desert floor. Nothing would survive impact. Connections to the Sharkoi fell away, one by one, as each alien vessel crashed into the ground. Elise was trying to clean the entire mess, a war that spread out across Karo. And all the while, she was slipping away herself, like dust in the wind. Jai stopped in the middle of the ramp and looked up at the shaft. They had several hundred meters to go. "We have 4 minutes," he said. "We can't make it to the top by then. Mike?" "Still no calm. Maybe if we went a little higher." He didn't sound confident, Melody thought. Melody's heart raced. These were going to be her last few minutes alive then. Noise thundered down the central shaft. "This is it," she thought. One of the Sharkoi leapt down from the mouth of the hole high above, dropping down to their level. "Go," it shouted. "We can't make it," Melody said. "Elise, there has to be another way." The Sharkoi looked up into the sky, and then, without further explanation, launched down into the darkness below. A single pelican dropped carefully down through the opening, the roar of its engines echoing all throughout the core shaft. The large, rugged shape obscured any sunlight from above. Melody moved closer to the edge and waved her hands, Gray Team and Rajka quickly joining her. With a blast of hot air, the pelican dropped level with them and spun about, wobbling as it backed the bay's ramp as close to them as the pilot could manage. Jai grabbed Melody by the waist and made the long leap first. Adriana and Mike came next. Rajka, though severely injured, refused assistance. He hobbled into a run and launched into the back of the pelican, then clattered across the floor toward the front of the aircraft. He lay where he slid to a stop, unable to move any further. Jai crouched by him. "He's badly injured. More than he'll let on. He's unresponsive. He needs medical help." "The governor sent us," the pilot interrupted. "Should I drop lower to get her as well?" "No," Melody said. "Get us out of here. As soon as possible." The ramp closed, and the pelican awkwardly rose, climbing up with increasing speed. Jai stood up and stepped over Rajka's slumped form. "There's a havoc down there about to blow. Aim for the sky and punch it." "Got it, sir," the pilot said. As the pelican's engines raised in pitch, everyone grabbed hold of something. Darkness slowly ate the edges of Elise's vision. Sharkoi advanced along the bridge, breaking free of her control and looming over her. She looked up through the shaft from another Sharkoi's eyes a final time, and saw the pelican climbing overhead, the air underneath it rippling hot from the howling engine exhaust. Peering down the tunnel to the pinpoint in the center of her fading vision, Elise stumbled over to the Havoc. 2 minutes left. But those three Sharkoi coming for her weren't going to wait. The winds inside this thing, the name popped into her mind, Vertex, weren't going to let her destroy it. They would protect it no matter the cost. Elise flipped the controls over to manual, turned the keys, pushed her palm out over the remote ignition she'd welded onto the frame. Blindness finally took her. The Vertex fighting back. How far away were the Sharkoi? How much longer could she delay this? She'd given the others every last second she could. It was time to secure Soraka's future. Elise took a breath and thought about Jeff, his voice, and his smile. She wondered if she would ever see him again. Then she pressed the button. The Pelican burst out of the Forerunner structure, nose high and engines screaming. Gray Team clutched the bay's jump seats, and Rajka slammed into the back of the vehicle with Melody piling on top of him. Jai looked ahead through the pilot's viewport. Only sky filled the view. As the aircraft righted itself, dipping forward to vector away from the crater, it banked hard, revealing the entire pit below through a starboard window. The ground shuddered and trembled. With a single jolt, the earth fell down into darkness. It looked as though something was sucking the entire crater down in on itself, as if the planet were taking a deep breath of dirt. Then the earth lifted up. Rock, dirt, and debris blown outward by an enormous fireball that liquefied and burned through everything, vaporizing the entire pit in a matter of seconds. The shockwave from the explosion raced below the Pelican and struck Soraka. The dropship shivered as a wall of dirt struck its belly. The force of the blast had risen higher than the pilot estimated. Alarms wailed, and the aircraft began to spin as the engines guttered out. "Crash positions!" the pilot shouted. Ahead of them, the shockwave struck the outskirts of Soraka. At the edge of the destruction, buildings swayed and collapsed. All the windows in the buildings that still stood disappeared in a spray of glass. Debris rained toward the ground. After everything it had suffered, the city would endure still more destruction. The Pelican spun around dizzyingly as the pilot fought to control the dead weight of the craft, as it careened toward tall, impossible-to-navigate buildings. Flaring hard, the pilot brought the dropship down low and attempted to stabilize it before impact. They struck the street and slid for half a block. The Pelican finally came to rest at the bottom of a bank, the floors gaping open to reveal the inner workings behind what had once been silvered windows. "Gray Team," Jai called. "Mike here. Adriana here." She sat up and rested her elbows on her knees. "Rajka?" The Sangheili could only groan in reply. "Melody," Jai asked.
"Yeah, I'm alive," she said.
The pilot dropped the ramp and Jai stepped out. A black cloud rose above the buildings. All that remained of the excavated crater now was an immense canyon, cut deep into the planet's crust. It roiled with a thick blanket of dust. All that was left of what had once been one of the Forerunner's darkest secrets. Chapter 28. Rajka watched the desert tilt and whirl from the back of a Pelican as they approached Rack with the rear bay ramp opened. The spires and great domes of the Sangheili keeps appeared in view as the aircraft banked once more for its descent. Home, Rajka thought. He never thought he'd see Rack again, especially at the very end. The sight now felt like a dream, as if a mirage had appeared in the desert. The Pelican's engines whined as it touched down on a sparse field just outside the city. Rack itself sprawled out along the valley, rock outcroppings jutting up into the air between the keeps. The river Astelhitch burbled down through the center of the entire city, surrounded by carefully maintained gardens that wound alongside it. A bright green paradise, hidden in the middle of a vast wasteland. Rajka thought back to contemplative walks he'd taken along the many decorative paths and bridges that crossed the Astelhitch.
He silently hoped he would be able to do so once more.
"Do we need to worry about that?" the pilot asked Rajka, the dropship's comm system translating into the Sangheili's own language. 30 Sangheili in full combat harnesses spread out around the edge of the field, weapons in their hands.
"I do not know," Rajka admitted.
He looked down at his own harness, battered beyond repair, and his empty hands. He was still exhausted, nursing broken ribs and strained muscles in his legs. It had been 2 full days since the event at Soraka. The humans had put his arm in some sort of sling, but he refused to use it for this return home. If these Sangheili were coming for him now, there would be little he could do to fight them.
"Thank you for the transportation, pilot. You should leave as soon as I step clear."
"That's the plan, yes, sir."
Rajka wearily got to his feet, limped down the ramp, and stepped out onto the field. As promised, the moment he was clear, the pelican lifted off and arced away over the rock outcroppings. Rajka looked at the blurred forms of the approaching Sangheili through the dust. Had they pledged loyalty to Tharz? Did they want to take control of the keep for themselves? Even with painkillers, set bones, and human medical care, Rajka fought to stand strong in the middle of the field.
"Kaidan Rajka!" the Sangheili in the lead shouted.
Rajka squinted. "To die here would be good," Rajka decided. His death would not go unnoticed.
He then recognized who addressed him.
"Kaidan Akato Dakaj."
Akato's warriors surrounded Rajka at a careful distance, their weapons in hand.
"So, you have returned. What are your intentions in these keeps of Rak?" Akato asked. "My intentions."
Rajka had spent the entire flight across the desert mulling that over. He looked past Akato.
"I wanted to see the city again. My city. Your city." "A poor choice of words," Rajka admitted. "I claim no ownership or leadership. But I put everything I had into building this place. I risked it all to come to this world. But during this war, I came to realize that I might never see Rak or my own keep again. I wanted to see both, at least one last time."
Akato's hands moved away from his sides.
"We have lost our fleet, Fleetmaster. We suffered at the hands of the Jiral Hunai. The Sharkoi almost entered the city. You do not have many friends here, Kaidan." "Kaidan."
Rajka felt a sliver of hope uncoil in his chest at hearing the word. "Many of the Sangheili in Rak chose Tharz. Tharz is now dead. I have taken my vengeance. He wasted our fleet in pursuit of his own plans. He invited the Jiral Hunai to this world, and he rightly bore the punishment for this. I do not seek the support of Sangheili who have turned their backs to me. But I am not interested in vengeance any longer. Even against the Demon Three, I am told they still live." "I fought with them," Rajka said, his shoulders hunched, then rose again as an invisible weight slid from them. "We spilled enemy blood together. We stood side by side to save this planet. I will not take their blood. Enough have died for the cause of war. I see no vengeance satisfied here. The war is over. And now I just wish to see my home." Rajka stood before Akato, waiting to see what might happen next. Akato had been a lesser Kaidan, relatively new to Rakoi. Rajka did not know him well, A profound change in the leadership of the keeps had certainly occurred here in Rajka's absence. Akato must have taken an opportunity to rise to power, because none of the Kaidans who had lent Thars their fighters were here to meet Rajka. That meant they were all dead. That also meant that Akato was now trying to decide if Rajka was an immediate threat to his new leadership. The Jirohanai began their attacks, Akato said softly, and without either your fleet or Tharz's. We were vulnerable. You fought to your end to try and stop this. But it should never have happened in the first place. Rajka inclined his head, but said nothing. Even though the attack ceased with their deaths, which we now know was thanks to the intervention of the human governor, we are still vulnerable. My most trusted advisors agree with me that without our fleet, this is the truth, Rajka. There is nothing above us, not a single ship. What are we without a fleet, Kaidan? I do not know, Rajka admitted. So we must face a new future as a result, one that acknowledges that all creatures living on this planet are vulnerable. You have clearly established an alliance with the humans. We need a speaker to them. And you believe I can be this? Rajka asked. In some ways, to some Sangheili, this would be a lesser role. It was clear that Akato was asserting his authority. Do you not think so? It would be a difficult position. But Rajka could still lead through influence, if not brute strength. Just like a human. He could influence both species that lived here, he realized. He could, like Melody Azikiwe, speak things into being. I agree that we do need the humans now, Rajka said. We are both rebuilding. We would be stronger together. The humans' Earth government will have their own fleet in orbit soon. And their attention. Sanghelios will no doubt be looking far more critically at us as well. I want Rak to survive. That is all I wish. I pledge that I will pose no threat to your leadership, Akato. I will speak to the humans for you. It felt so alien to say such things. He was turning his back on many years of yearning and aspiration for leadership through combat and other means. Both the Sangheili and the humans had lost so much to war, but there was the rebuilding to oversee if either of them were to survive here. There was a peace to be secured with the humans, a future to work toward, a future that Rajka had learned after all he had been through. He wanted to see made. I will be your envoy, Rajka said. Akato nodded to the group of Sangheili. They opened the circle up and fell in behind as Akato swept an arm out toward the keeps lining the valley. Rak. Welcome home then, Rajka. We have much to discuss. The future of this city and of this world. Thank you, Kaidan. Rajka fell into step beside him, walking back toward his home, and a very new and different future. Yet one he now welcomed. The heavily armored, gun-like shape of the UNSC frigate Welcome to the Snipe Hunt popped out of slipspace just above Kara. When Jai saw it approach from the cockpit of the Pelican, he turned to Adriana and Mike. Are we ready for this? He asked privately over the team's helmets. Melody, up in the cockpit, glanced back and gave them a thumbs up. Jai nodded to her. Time to face the music, Adriana said. The war is over. The Covenant is gone. Maybe we'll be discharged. To be honest, I never thought about what the end of our fight would look like. Do you really think Oni has changed? Mike asked. Or that the fight is over? They used us before the Covenant showed up. You know they'll keep doing it afterward, too. There was a long silence in the Pelican as the dropship moved to meet the frigate's open hangar bay. Mike looked over at them.
We're Spartans, he said. I don't know anything else. I have nothing else.
So we stay together and see what's coming? Chai asked.
There are still threats out here, Mike said. We saw what happened to the Sarakans, the brutes and the elites.
I don't think fighting is over.
What about Glaki?
There's a possibility they'll try us as war criminals to save face for what happened to that world, Chai said. You know that, right? You're prepared for that?
I'm ready for anything.
Welcome to the Snipe Hunt swallowed the Pelican, which settled into the hangar bay. It had been 6 years since Chai had been inside a UNSC ship. 6 years. Chai paused as the ramp opened enough for him to see what was waiting for them. What is this? He asked out loud. Dozens of crew members lined the hangar bay in full dress uniforms, positioned perfectly by their rank. One of them called out a command to salute, and they responded in unison. Melody stepped into the middle of Gray Team.
They're here to see you, she explained. Not many Spartans of your generation survived the war.
This is strange, Chai said. They're here to honor you. Take it in, Spartan. Look around. Know that your enemies have died, and that you lived, Melody said.
Those words, Chai thought, are very Sangheili. She'd spent a lot of time with the aliens. He wondered how much had rubbed off.
Earth survived, Melody said, and now Kero survives. We are still alive to build a future because of the sacrifices you all have made.
Do you still believe in futures, Jai?
Jai looked at the crowds, waiting expectantly.
I didn't think there was one when we were floating around Glaki, before we went under.
Didn't think there was one when you unfroze us.
And now?
Melody raised an eyebrow. A lot changed down on Kero, Jai said.
Well then, Melody said, try believing in one.
She walked past him and stepped down off the ramp. Jai followed her, with Adriana and Mike flanking him. The landing bay filled with deafening applause that reverberated off the walls.
Jai's right. This is strange, Adriana muttered.
You've come back heroes, Melody told her.
We're not heroes, Adriana said to her. We just followed orders as best we could in a horrible situation.
They see heroes.
Now, come.
Melody led them through the assembled crew and to the officers waiting to receive them. The officers saluted the Spartans as Melody introduced them.
I'm so sorry. We have to cut this short, Melody said to them. I'm told we have a meeting in one of the briefing rooms.
Of course, a visibly disappointed lieutenant said. Chief Petty Officer Dunkirk here will lead your way. CPO Dunkirk looked less starstruck than the lieutenant. He silently led them through the ship's corridors. Jai found the familiar angled doorways and long hallways reassuring. He'd come home in some way. CPO Dunkirk stopped outside a briefing room near the bridge.
Thank you, Melody told him in a tone that clearly relieved him of any further need to hang around.
She looked at the battered Spartans.
Ready?
In answer, Jai opened the door and stepped in. An Oni officer waited there. He looked briefly annoyed when he saw Melody. The look disappeared under a familiar mask of calm.
I'm Commander Yerrick. I'm here to help Gray Team reintegrate. Most of the commanding officers Gray Team dealt with are no longer operational. I'll be taking over where they left off.
Before we talk about reintegration, Melody started to say.
Ms. Azakiwe, Yerrick interrupted. You've already detailed your concerns. Our current admiral has experience with the Spartan II program and its pressures. She is quite familiar with the situation and what is needed moving forward. We have the best people at our disposal to work with, Gray Team. The first step for them will be some basic functionality analyses and some shore leave back on Earth. That seemed to mollify Melody slightly, but she didn't back down.
This team has given a lot out there. You understand that, right?
Yerrick's lips thinned.
Ms. Azakiwe, you work for the Diplomatic Corps. While your services to the Office of Naval Intelligence are highly regarded and valued, they are also no longer required. Now I need you to leave the room while I continue to debrief, Gray Team. I understand you need to be making arrangements with Governor Lamar Edwards for a continuing mission here on Kero.
Jai watched Melody realize she had been dismissed just as matter-of-factly as she had dismissed Officer Dunkirk. But Melody wasn't about to back down, so Jai decided to defuse the situation before it escalated.
It's okay, Envoy. We'll be all right. There's still a lot that needs to be worked out with Soraka. Thank you for looking out for us. We'll talk to you after this is all sorted out.
Reluctantly, Melody turned around and left the room.
Sir.
What about what happened on Glaki? Jai asked after she left. The question had been waiting over their heads like a dark cloud.
Yerrick folded his arms. You have a choice in front of you, Spartans.
Go on.
Some are recommending decommissioning, Gray Team. A general discharge or hardship discharge. A reintegration team would be assigned to you, but there would be some conditions attached to it.
Yerrick looked at them, curious as to their reaction.
Jai looked over at Adriana and Mike. I didn't think only let Spartans become civilians, he said.
I didn't say that we did,
Yerrick responded. There are other ways we can employ your skills that don't involve public exposure. Only a handful of people know about what happened on Glaki. Some of them are Sangheili allies that we'd like to keep in our graces. This would be a public-facing decommission only.
The bottom line about Glaki is that although it was tragic, it was not novel. Planetary genocide was effectively done to humanity repeatedly over the course of the war. The Sangheili know this and we know it, which is why we're putting the decision in your hands.
Jai nodded slowly, the world around him pulling back into a focus he hadn't realized he'd lost.
We're Spartans, sir. We can't be anything but Spartans. We're not stepping away.
That's not Gray Team.
He had spoken on their behalf. He tensed, expecting an objection. But neither Adriana nor Mike said anything. They gave him quick nods, their visors tipping forward ever so slightly.
Gray Team is back, Jai thought.
The war we were fighting appears to be over, Jai continued. We've obviously got some catching up to do.
But even we can see that whatever is left of the Covenant is still causing trouble. The UNSC can barely control whole worlds like Kero this far out from Earth.
You're not done with us, sir. I think we all know that.
So, what's the other choice?
Commander Yerrick smiled.
You're right. Oni would prefer to keep Gray Team intact and active. The Forerunners left a lot of secrets littered around the galaxy. Many of them have been popping up on human colonies. Artifacts and technology are scattered throughout the Joint Occupied Zone, which obviously makes our peace extremely tenuous. Humanity is vulnerable, Spartans, especially way out here. We need a specialized strike force that we can send out into the dark, where the UNSC doesn't have formal coverage, that can keep us safe.
And you think we are that team?
Part of it.
Yerrick held out his hands. See, if you agree to come back on in this capacity, we can offer you a formal pardon that the Arbiter, the Sangheili leader Thel Vadam, has put together along with others under him. Then you would join a team.
We are a team, Mike said. We don't work with others, sir.
Right, Adriana said. We go out, alone. That's how we've always done this.
Yerrick smiled. I'm actually talking about an interspecies team, trained to work together to face whatever out there that is threatening us. We've never worked with others, Adriana said, tapping the table. Not even other Spartans. But that isn't true, Jai thought. They'd worked with Rajka. They'd fought alongside Melody. We'll need some time to think about that, Jai said. If you want back in, this is how it goes. Can you believe this? Adriana said privately via Jai's helmet. Then, disgusted, Oni. If we do this, I want a UNSC prowler at our disposal, Mike said to Yerrick. What? Yerrick asked, twisting to face Mike directly. I'm not doing this unless we have a stealth corvette. Something fast and with slipspace capability, Mike said. We're not hitching rides anymore, or taking 6-year naps. We get our own ship. A prowler. Yerrick looked around at the Spartans. If you're amenable to what I'm proposing, I'll see what I can do, he said. I have requests as well, Adriana said. If the Sangheili are our allies now, I have a whole other list of weaponry I want to stock up on. It's an extensive list. Jai smiled. It would take a long time for that weight they'd been carrying to fully slide away. But they'd turned a corner. They were broken. They were bruised, but they were still Grey Team. Melody walked through the hallways of Welcome to the Snipe Hunt. Soon they'd be underway, back to Earth, back to suits and cocktail mixers with diplomats, paperwork, and the hum of offices. She'd go back having saved a world, though. There was a future to be built on Kara. Soon there would be ships with even more diplomats on their way out here, as the UEG created official channels. Formally, they would claim that a portion of Kara that contained Soraka was an outer colony. A piece of this world would fall under the jurisdiction of the UEG. They would bankroll repairs and handle any fallout as a result of the Sangheili and Jirohanai attack. Sanghelios would likely do the same for Rak, which meant that somewhere out in the old desert, between Soraka and Rak, would be an actual land border between the UEG and the Sangheili. In practice, Melody knew the UEG didn't have the ability to force Soraka back in right now. So at least for the next few years, a form of realpolitik would have to be exercised here. Likely the same for the Sangheili. Kara would be treated like it was independent, although on paper everything would change. Melody would be an unofficial ambassador, not just between Soraka and the UEG, but between the UEG and the Sangheili. Now where would that put her on the climb up the organizational chart? That sort of fieldwork would go far in her working her way up the ranks. It would unlock assignments she hadn't even dreamed of. In the past, she would have been quite elated by that. But instead, she was here walking the corridors of the Snipe Hunt. When was the last time she'd slept, or thought about her staff? She would have to write the letters to their families. How am I supposed to feel after a battle? In the last couple of days, whenever she lay down and tried to close her eyes, sleep fled from her, like she was trying to hold on to water. They'd given her sleeping patches. She knew she'd be poked and prodded a whole lot more when she arrived back on Earth. It had taken years of therapy for her to come to terms with growing up as a civilian in a war. How many years would it take for her to come to terms with what had just happened? Did that mean that, just like back then, she wouldn't stop feeling dazed? That she'd never feel relief? That she had another long journey ahead of her? The thought frightened her. She'd been keeping busy the past few days since coming back up out of the Forerunner structure, trying to keep all that buried. Melody stopped in front of a cabin door. She knocked gently on it, ignoring the comm system. Hello, she said when it opened.
Adriana 111 stood on the threshold, wearing shorts and a halter top. No helmet, no armor. Her pale face stood out in the dark. Too much time under the armor. Too much time under an alien sun. Adriana ran a hand through buzz-cut hair. "Can't sleep?" Adriana asked.